Greetings once again for the 605 Super Podcast. I'm the great Brian Last, along with David Bixenspan, for another week of old school wrestling talk on 605, the only podcast on Turner Time. Bix, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay. It is Hanukkah season, so I'm in a good mood. We also have a Christmas tree because we're a mixed household, and I put the Roddy Piper thumb wrestler at the top of the tree where the star is supposed to go. Yeah, Suzanne said, she goes, that's not a star. It's like, who are you to say Roddy Piper's not a star?
Indeed.
Yeah.
Certainly more than most wrestlers.
right, exactly. So before we get going with anything new, why don't we follow up on any of the topics that are still up in the air from the previous week's episode?
So I guess we really just have the fate of the second PBA Diaz to talk about, right? I don't think there was really anything else that got addressed in the last week, right?
Well, let's talk about his fate. Bix, is El Pibe Diaz Dos still alive?
Well, maybe. I don't know about now, but he did not die.
No, I want an answer.
I guess
is he alive?
I guess he is.
Okay. So, well, what did we find out about this?
Well, because if you noticed on the video, it was some re-aired version that was like a pop-up video type version. And it said that he was okay, I guess, relatively speaking, and wrestled the next week and was fine. And, oh, I'm trying to remember. Didn't it say something about what he's doing now? And I forgot what it is.
I'm trying to think of who was that he ran a business doing it, or he was a stuntman, but he ran a stunt school, maybe?
He ran a stunt school and became a stuntman. And
he got a good head start landing on his head. Don't do this. Lesson one, don't do a dive onto the guy in the yellow shirt.
Yeah. So that was, I was sort of, is it me or were you almost sort of disappointed that he was okay? You know what I mean.
You deviant. I was surprised that he went on to work in stunts. I want to send a message out there. We still would like to speak to either PB Diaz Dos or PB Diaz Uno. If you're out there listening, como estoy?
What?
Muy bien?
That's not...
I don't know. That's not right. What you're supposed to say?
No, como estás.
Como estás. I live with a Colombian. I should know.
Or como está usted, depending on...
Como está usted?
Okay.
PB. The kid. The kid 10. There's some questions I still have about the whole thing.
So I think it did seem like people were agreeing that he is supposed to be a 10-year-old kid. But that he was based on like Chespirito's little kid character.
That doesn't explain him coming out, Pibe Diaz Uno, with all of the club rats. I don't know who they were. These women just dancing around. That doesn't explain. It explains second Pibe Diaz coming out with the children with antennas, but it doesn't explain the first one.
Well,
he doesn't. I mean, other than the suspenders, he's nothing like El Chavo.
No, but didn't he say it was like a combination of El Chavo and some other Chespirito character?
Yes, that is what we were tweeted.
And I apologize that I didn't say that, keep track of who told us this.
By the way, thank you everyone who did get in touch with us. I'm glad that other people were concerned about the whereabouts and the health of El Pibe Diaz Dos.
Yeah.
And one of the good things, I guess, that came out of it was from what we heard on Twitter and a few other places, that some people gained an interest in Titanus and El Ring due to our talk. So that makes me happy.
Yes, Titanus and El Ring featuring Long Beach's own Martin Caradagian.
That's right. You have to listen to the previous week's episode to understand that.
That might have been the first one, actually.
That might have been the first one. That might have been the first one. But that's the update on El Pibe Diaz. I suggest you still go to the video on YouTube and show all your friends.
So, I guess actually the WWE Network stuff is also a follow-up. So, last week, what had they uploaded so far when we did the show? Or when we recorded the show, at least. It was just the additional Crockett, the Mid-South, and the Smoky Mountain, right?
I believe so.
Okay. So, then they added... So, it was Stampede Wrestling, all from 78 to 79... and a section for the GWF that now consists entirely, though, so far, of USWA syndicated shows. So, you know, the Dallas USWA.
Did you say AWA also?
Yes. There was also AWA. I'm trying to remember if that had gone up yet. I feel like I might be forgetting something then. I don't know. But yeah, AWA also. There was also AWA, and they did add more World Class too. Yeah, that's what it was. I don't think we had talked about the AWA and World Class yet, because they added AWA. Maybe we did. I don't really remember. But they added AWA from like 86 to 88, mostly with Shawn Michaels and guys like that, and some World Class. I think it was mostly 86, 87, which is unfortunate, but it has guys like Warrior. And an episode from early 85 with Michaels getting squashed by Woman Gang.
I have to admit, I can't watch any World Class after Gino's dead. It just, I can't watch the Sportatorium when it's not alive.
Yeah. I mean, I can watch like a little bit after that, like, I guess until everyone leaves for UWF. But that's, right. I mean, it's right after that anyway.
That's like a month later, two months later. Yeah. You know, last week on the show, I said that, I had canceled my WWE Network subscription a while ago. I had been only watching primetime wrestling from 86. And until they uploaded shows in weekly order, I wasn't going to have any faith in them doing it and come back. And then, you know, the next day on Twitter, everyone's going crazy because, oh, they added this show, they added that show. Now, they're all over the place. No shows in, you know, show 401, show 402, show 403.
Although the Crockett stuff is pretty close, and they've been filling in the gaps with that. And the Smoky Mountain is close-ish, at least in the shows they've put up.
Right. I mean, it's all from the summer of 94, I guess, I gather. And so,
well, it's not like Jericho was exactly there long.
No. I mean, he was there a few months. So,
well, because he broke his arm and he wouldn't sleep with the rats.
Well, half of that story is absolutely true. The other half is what I've heard recently, so I'm not exactly sure.
Okay.
But so I said, I'm not coming back until they show me something. And then they upload all these shows, and the next day I'm like, oh, God, why did I say that? I'm really tempted to watch, you know, the AWA and USWA B shows. I mean, just weird stuff that they put up there.
Well, that's what's one of the things that really amazed me is that, I mean, they didn't put a lot of these up, but they put up one episode each of USWA main events and AWA superstars. And AWA, so for those who don't know, with AWA, you had All Star Wrestling, which was the long running syndicated show. Championship Wrestling was the ESPN show. And then Superstars was this like syndicated B show that I had only ever heard of from Larry Nelson's book, to the point that I wasn't even sure if it existed and he was just making it up.
Yeah.
And I have not watched it yet, but it has Larry Nelson complaining about his orthopedic chair. It seems like it was just to goof off, that they just did a lot. And he talked about that in his book, I believe, like goofing off on the air with that show.
Well, that must have been right before he left also.
When did he leave? Because was this from 86?
Was it 86? I thought it was 88. Okay.
No, I'm saying, I'm trying to remember when it was from. It was from 88. It's probably one of his last shows, yeah.
Right.
So that's interesting. And USWA main events, which I don't think I had ever seen, and I don't think aired anywhere in our footprint. I mean, that's probably the wrong word to use, but in or around New York, which was, because USWA Challenge was the show that had been World Class Championship Wrestling. USWA main events was the show that had been Wild West Wrestling, right, which after Wild West Wrestling stopped having original shows. I think if Wikipedia is to be believed, and in this case I do, because Wikipedia's World Class entry is actually fantastic, it became like a mix of like older matches, like recent-ish but older matches, and maybe like a few months old Fort Worth matches. And then that became USWA main events, which it looks like, you know, was just a mix of, you know, stuff from months ago. And, like, no wraparounds or anything, though. There is no context given to it. So it's actually the perfect WWE Network show.
Yeah, really.
But, you know, there was some good stuff, though, like Jerry Lawler and Jeff Jarrett, on that. And they also put up three volumes of Global Wrestling Federation Presents the Best of the USWA, which I presume is some kind of, like, international home video release.
Yeah, that is interesting.
And because usually this vault stuff is just TV. And I only watched the first volume but it consisted mostly of stuff from the GWF pilot TV taping from the end of 1990. Do you know the taping I'm talking about?
I think so.
Lawler versus...
Oh, okay. No, I was going to say Stan Lane, Cornette, Demolition Axe, but it
No. It ended up airing as USWA Challenge, like, through January 1991, but it was the last taping in 1990. And this was when they had the Lawler versus Terry Funk match from the Sportatorium where Scotty the Body's at ringside scouting them. And what else? That really great Jeff Jarrett versus Eddie Gilbert match where they do the, like, dusty finish at the end. Doc and Gordy coming in to do a squash as a one-shot thing. Cactus Jack, one-man gang in as one-shot. Even Akira Nagami even worked the taping, but I don't think it made TV.
Wow.
So some cool stuff, but really, I'm glad that that Jarrett-Gilbert match is on the network because it's one of my favorite matches. So I'm curious to see what's on Volumes 2 and 3.
Yeah, so all this happens, and I'm so tempted, and you tell me that to subscribe to some or follow some Twitter feed that the guy posts everything new that's added to the network.
It's a robot as soon as it goes up.
Every few minutes, I'm seeing, like, Smoky Mountain ad added, Global added, AWA added. I'm like, oh, my God, like, they're actually starting to get me. And then it stopped, and then it became WWF main event added, you know, the best of the week, superstar.
Right. They stopped for the last several days, and then they took down the Stampede stuff on, I guess it was Sunday?
Well, before we even get there. So yeah. I stopped subscribing because I don't care about the current product because it's awful.
And because they stopped updating most of the older stuff.
Right, and that's all I want to see. Vince McMahon doesn't have any idea what he's doing anymore, and the current product's terrible. I only want to see the classic stuff, so I stopped. So them adding all this stuff in the last week was one of the very few things they could do to tempt me to come back. Mm-hmm. I held firm. I didn't. Now they've stopped adding stuff. We'll see when they start again. We'll see if this is just like a giant release like it was when they first started, and they put all the world class up, and then they stopped. So I get an email today from WWE Customer Service, and the header is, "We want you back!" Exclamation point. Now, I don't care about any of the current product, and they send me this email, and it's a giant picture of Sheamus and a giant picture of Roman Reigns. Restart your subscription. Sheamus will defend the title against Roman Reigns in a table, ladders, and chairs match. Tables, ladders, chairs, I don't care. They should send me an email with JYD and Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes and Roddy Piper.
They put up so much of this stuff, especially the Crockett stuff. Yeah, that's the thing. They have not been advertising this at all anywhere.
You have to acknowledge that you have a giant fan base that really doesn't care about your current product, but you could still take their money. And if they would send me something that was, it doesn't have to be personalized, but, you know, do a survey of everyone. What exactly is your favorite thing? What are you watching?
Right.
And not just customize the emails.
Yeah.
Send me something with classic wrestling on it.
And the thing is, they are sending out surveys to people, not necessarily about the network, but it's to these people who proactively signed up for their fan council thing, which, unless you hear about it, is not necessarily something you're just going to find. And right now it's like filled up if you try to sign up too. But yeah, I don't get it. They added a lot. And well, I'll ask you this. When did you cancel originally?
Originally? Yeah. I canceled like right away. I originally signed up for the month to month when that's what it was. But you had to commit for a year.
Well, six months or whatever.
Right. Yeah. I didn't commit to anything. I used PayPal and I canceled that thing as soon as I was done with it, which is like, I don't know, a month into it, 2 months into it.
And I wonder if they actually knew that would happen, by the way.
I don't know if they know anything, to be quite honest with you. At some point, the shareholders have to stand up and say, what the hell's going on?
So you didn't even wait, though, till like April or May where it became clear that they were stopping uploading the classic stuff?
I may have. Okay. I'm not exactly sure.
Go ahead.
I could tell you that I started again last year around the time of WrestleMania because I wanted to see Lesnar versus Roman Reigns. I wanted to see Lesnar kill him. And except for the finish, that's exactly what the match was. It was great.
So probably let's say June of last year, and then you subscribed again for March of this year, or April, whichever it was.
Yeah. Around then. Yeah. And then I stayed maybe 2 months because I was going at that point I was going through all the prime times in order, and that was it. That was all I was watching.
Now they have never sent you any email about any classic content that was added, whether it was the prime times, the TNT,
no,
the ECWs, the Nitros, the Raws, nothing.
They've never sent me an email about classic content. They've never sent me an email to ask me why I left. Mm-hmm. They've never sent me anything to ask me to come back that was targeted in any way towards me. Again, I'm staring at this picture of Roman Reigns and Sheamus. They both look ridiculous.
Well, it doesn't even have to be targeted, though.
I don't care about either one of these guys. Why would I subscribe?
Well, the thing is, though, it doesn't even have to be targeted. That's
I mean, no. It could be a picture of Gorilla Monsoon saying, hey, look what we added, and just having a list of things.
Or just pick, or like you said, Ric Flair, Dusty Rhodes, JYD, you know, whatever. There you go. Right?
Yeah. Right.
I don't understand what, like, they have not ever, like, I guess, no, they did, I feel like maybe they did push some of them on Raw, though, which is great if you're watching Raw. Like, I think they
I don't
maybe,
watch Raw.
Well, that's what I'm saying, yeah. I
the only communication I have with WWE is through these emails they send me. And they send them fairly regularly. It's always before one of their little pay-per-views.
Well, that's
and it's
what,
always a picture of The Undertaker or a picture of the Wyatt family or this. And I don't care.
Well, and also what's so stupid about that, too, is like a lot of services would try to offer you something if they're trying to win you back. Them, it's always just, hey, we have a pay-per-view. And it's like, don't you think that if don't they think that if you are watching and interested in the pay-per-view, you would subscribe?
Yeah, I mean, and another thing is I get emails from Netflix and I subscribe to Netflix.
Yeah.
Brian, we just added a movie you might like. And they recommend things based on what I've watched already.
Well, that's because Netflix has the money because they have a recommendation engine and WWE is not invested in anything like that.
But even if it doesn't go based on a recommendation, they could still generate an email that says, Brian, we've added some shows you may like.
No, it's inexcusable. That they have not done emails for adding the classic stuff is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
But enough about that. So they added the Stampede stuff, and I watched some of it. First thing I noticed, though, because the Stampede, for those who don't know, was very behind other territories technologically, like grossly. they were black and white through, based on what we have, what, early 70s, I guess?
At least.
And then film through 80, I guess?
Yeah, about there. I mean, yeah.
And then, so it looks like, though, they have the original films and they rescan them in HD. So the shows look awesome. I mean, they don't look like, you know, they don't look like a great 16mm movie in HD or like.
But still, if it's 16mm like, and you make it HD, it's going to be beautiful.
Well, yeah, I mean, it looks nicer than anything else, you know, from that era. And it does, but it you know, it doesn't look like, say, the Nirvana concert that came out on DVD, on Blu-ray from, it's not Blu-ray, but you get my idea. You get that it didn't look quite as great as something like that, but it looked really, really good. So they're using the original films. They're not using transfers to videotape. And someone pointed out to me that the Dusty Flair rivalry show, the Florida Dusty clips, apparently were also rescanned. I looked a little. It didn't look – I mean, it looked like they might have been, but they didn't look quite as well taken care of. But anyway, some interesting stuff on these. And then on Sunday, they took these down because whoever was involved in putting this stuff up did not know that Bret Hart technically owns his Stampede matches.
It's interesting. I mean, they obviously took them down. I wonder, does Bret Hart have a claim if he wanted to say, you guys owe me money now?
I'm sure
they broadcasted something he owns the rights to.
Yes. It's not a royalties thing. He owned it. I'm going to guess they're going to work something out because, Observer Radio, Dave was talking about how he got in touch with him and he was like, he didn't really want to get a lawyer involved or anything, but, you know, he hadn't dealt with them on any of this. And, you know, in the past, you know, he's worked with them on DVDs and put this stuff on it, but, you know, they got to arrange something with them first. So they took it down.
It's also one of those things, if you don't keep WWE in check, they will just keep doing whatever they want to do. You have to make sure as soon as they violate something, you put them back in the check.
Yeah. So that was disappointing. I mean, I guess we'll see. I mean, you know, the Owen DVD's out now, so I don't know if to hype that, if maybe they'll put up some Owen-era Stampede stuff. So, it's only the Bret stuff that's an issue.
How was, after all these years, Bix, how was it listening to Ed Whalen?
Oh, God. I mean, he's good in small doses for what he is. But, you know, like, as long as you're not seeing him edit an angle or a bloody match off TV or take away a heel's heat, he's fine. But, I don't know. Like, I mean, there was some fun stuff, like, where he was lying down next to an injured and after he lost to John Foley in the ring. So that was kind of amusing. And also, one of the shows had the promo where John Foley became J.R. Foley. Talking about his inheritance. So
that's cool. That's cool.
Now, did you see the screenshot I tweeted, though, that showed just how nice the stuff
was? I mean, it looked great. I mean, yeah. I figured anything on film, anything that's on 16 millimeter and it's been preserved is going to look beautiful in HD.
Yeah, it seemed like it was preserved pretty well. I mean, and it wasn't even, you know, it's not even full HD. I think the network goes up to 720p.
Well, you know, it's pretty chilly up there in Calgary, so it's a good environment to store
tapes.
Yeah,
I guess so. I guess so. So, unfortunately, that stuff's not on there.
You know, Ed Whalen is a guy who everyone was always critical of, and it's quite understandable, especially considering some of the things he did in terms of editing angles off TV and stuff. But, you know, it makes me think that there was always this consensus that Ed Whalen was terrible and Bill Mercer was terrible. And I've really grown in my older years here to enjoy Bill Mercer's commentary, I have to say.
See, I like Mark Lawrence, but I haven't been as fond of Bill Mercer.
I'm going to say it again in case anyone didn't listen to the episode of Between the Sheets I was on a few weeks ago. My favorite Mark Lawrence line is, "The winner of the match, Kevin."
Because that's all you need to know.
that's world class in a nutshell right there. That could be the name of the world class book. The winner of the match, Kevin. I mean, if it was a world class book that didn't deal with everything else behind the scenes. But yeah, Ed Whalen, I still, you know, there's just something bad about him. And whenever you hear Brett or someone who grew up there do an interview, they say, "Oh, he was the best announcer. He was the greatest wrestling announcer." You know, it's all about, I guess, who you grew up with.
Well, yeah, I mean, and Bruce will alternatively call him the best and talk about how much he ruined everything.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's Bruce. Well,
you know? And he's probably, I don't know. I mean, you know what, though? If you're Bruce, like, I can see also why you'd like Whalen in a way, though, because Whalen really loved those, you know, they called them mid-heavyweight matches.
Yeah.
And he really was sincerely loving calling those. And that was like, that was what he really loved. And that was Bruce's division, you know, with Dynamite and those guys. So I can see how he'd have a fondness for him in that sense. So the thing I wanted to talk about, and that will just kind of go into like our regular jumping off points now, is so one of those shows, I think maybe more than one of the shows, I guess, had Junkyard Dog as a rookie as Big Daddy Ritter. And I guess this was his first long stint in a territory, because I think it was in his Observer obituary that he had briefly been in Memphis.
Yes, he had. Yes.
But very briefly, right? Like a few weeks.
I'm not sure if it was a few weeks or a month or two, but he was definitely there.
It was not long, though. I don't think.
Okay. I take your word for it.
Anyway, so, you know, he's already a great promo. And unfortunately, we don't have enough JYD promos because we don't have the local promos from Mid-South from when he was a star there. And we also don't have, you know, the first, you know, year, you know, 2 years or whatever of him in Mid-South. And but here he's already a great promo. And that so but the match he has is with this old guy, Patty Ryan, like kind of like, yeah, I would say not really heavy set, just kind of like a guy who let himself go. And they have this really, like, bloody, heated match, and it's actually really good. And I'd have to find the actual passage, but I think Brett did talk about Patty Ryan in his book, that maybe he had one of his first matches with him and that he carried him really well. So maybe Patty Ryan really was, like, a really, really good worker. But even if he was, between this and the Mid-South I've seen and some of the Houston stuff, like, I'm starting to think that JYD being this awful, terrible, irredeemable worker is a myth.
It's a lot of it is based on his work post 1985.
Well, I'd amend that too, because based on his work from once he started having the coke problem and the marital problems.
Right. I mean, if you watch 1990 JYD, yeah, it's rough. Anything after that, it's really, really rough. But, you know, he, first of all, you got to understand, he's not someone who's going to go have a 60-minute match. Not that anyone would want to watch that. He's not going to have a 20-minute match for the most part. And he shouldn't. That wasn't you know, not everyone should do what everyone else does. Andre the Giant shouldn't go do moonsaults.
No.
JYD should have short action, you know, short matches where he ends it with the thump. And that was it. And it worked. I mean, it worked amazingly well. I mean, for what he needed to be JYD, he was perfect. And I will say for the record here, I'm someone who thinks JYD belongs in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. Because
I voted for him.
Because for 5 years, he was one of the biggest stars in the wrestling industry. He was the second most over guy in the WWF to Hogan up until they changed his theme music at the end of 1985. Mm-hmm. He had good matches. People may not want him in with Ted DiBiase, with Nick Bockwinkel, with the him and Watts against the Midnight Express set records all throughout that territory.
Butch Reed,
his feud with the Freebirds made every wrestling promoter in the rest of the country go, who the hell are these guys? We've never heard of the Freebirds. We've never heard of the Junkyard Dog. And they just sold out – or not sold out, excuse me. They just drew, what was it, 32,000 to 28,000?
I think it was like 28,000, 29,000, which was the largest crowd in the history of Louisiana wrestling until this year's – or last year's WrestleMania.
Right. He was the biggest drawing card in the history of Mid-South wrestling, and then as an attraction was sent to Mid-Atlantic, Georgia – World Class, Memphis. He was one of the first people Vince went after when he started All American Wrestling, and he started putting matches from other territories of people he expected to poach on there. JYD was one of the very first people up on there. JYD, for a five-year period, was as big a wrestling star as there was. He was all over the Apter magazines, too. And again, he was all over the Apter magazines as a star from Mid-South, which, although we love Mid-South and we talk about what a great territory it was technically, you know, for all intents and purposes, it was in the middle of nowhere. It was a small territory that just happened to have all this great action. It wasn't a glamorous territory like a Mid-Atlantic or a Florida or a Georgia.
And especially when he first popped the territory, Watts had not taken over all of McGurk's territory yet.
Right. That's a very good point. It was Louisiana and Arkansas?
I think Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi.
Yeah, he didn't even have Oklahoma. His home, Watts didn't even have. He didn't have Tulsa.
Right, yeah, Tulsa was still, through what was it, like middle of 82 or something? Was when? Maybe a little before that, early 82?
Maybe, well, they were running Shreveport already by that point. So I got to feel like once they were running Shreveport, they always had
Shreveport, though, Mid-South.
They did?
Because the stuff on the 2-inch stuff, there's stuff from 79.
Oh, you may be right.
Yeah, and that's because I think
Reeser Bowden. If Reeser's there, it has to be there. That's right.
I think there's like some stuff where it's where it's still McGurk, and then there's some stuff where it's.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm getting Shreveport, Louisiana, confused with Oklahoma.
Yes, Shreveport's in Louisiana. Shreveport's not Oklahoma.
But yeah, they weren't even running Oklahoma yet, and they weren't even in Houston, I don't think, yet. They got into Houston, 82?
Houston was, 82 when they replaced Southwest.
And JYD was a major star there, too.
Didn't JYD actually get booked into Houston before Mid-South became the main booking office for Houston?
You know, I think so, but I'm not certain, so I can't say that.
Because Mid-South was technically an independent and not an NWA member, so it wasn't a bad thing or something anyone could cry foul over if JYD got booked into Houston while they were booking talent from Joe Blanchard.
You know, and Dave kind of made in The Observer an argument similar to this about Kerry Von Erich. For a period of time, Kerry was one of the biggest stars in wrestling and went as a touring attraction all over, but his period of time wasn't as long as JYD's.
No, and I'm not even saying that Kerry would be undeserving, but also the thing we didn't mention, which JYD yet that we should mention. He did all this as a black guy in a territory based in Louisiana, feuding with Lynyrd Skynyrd listening to Confederate flag wearing rock and roll heels.
Yeah. Although to some of those people, rock and roll may have been just as bad as being an African American. You know, well, who was the promoter? The Klansman, who whenever JYD would do the local promos, he would go out of his way to tell Reese Bowden, "Oh, I can't wait to go to a barbecue at his house. It's my favorite thing to do." And then he would get grief from the other Klansmen. He would tell Bill Watts, "Please have him stop telling people he's coming to my house for a barbecue."
Wait,
he's
what? I don't know about that.
Oh yeah, I forget which promoter it was. I wanted to say George Culkin, but I don't think that's the right guy. But one of the local promoters for Watts was pretty well known to be in the Klan.
Okay.
So whenever JYD would come to, you know, do the local promos for his shows, he would do his interview, talk about whoever he was wrestling, and then go, oh, you know, oh boy, Reeser, I can't wait to go to his house. He does the best barbecues every time. He always treats me so well. It's my favorite thing to do in town. And then the other people in the clan would tell him, like, so you're hanging out with that boy, huh? You know, and he would get all this grief, and then he would go back to Bill Watts and say, please have JYD stop saying he comes to my house for barbecue. Oh, I wish I could remember who it was now. I can't remember the name.
Oh, wow. I have not heard that one.
And if you track his career, he went from, you know, obviously we think he was in Memphis, and then it was Stampede, back to Mid-South, where he was pretty instantly over, but then he became just massive. And then where? Georgia, and then back.
Well, Georgia was Georgia 81? During the first Loser Leaves Town, or was that just concurrent with him working shots? I think he was just doing shots.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Well, because the first because that was 81, I think, and then
it was 81,
and then whatchamacallit, first Stagger Lee angle was 82, wasn't it?
Right. S. Lee is Stagger Lee.
Yes.
Randy Anderson was the guy who brought the sign.
Yes,
down.
Yes.
That's right. Pee Wee Anderson. What's his background? Now that I think about it, he did that, and then he was a referee in Mid-South, and then obviously for years and years and years he was with WCW. But what is actually – where did he come from?
I believe he was one of Arn Anderson's best friends in high school.
Really?
And they, I think, were on the wrestling team together.
Wow. Wow. Didn't know that.
Well, and they were in Mid-South around the same time too. Marty Lundy and Randy Anderson started there around the same time, didn't they?
I was thinking he was there before Marty Lundy was, because Marty Lundy was, what, 83, or was he 82?
I think, but it might have been late 82.
Okay, maybe that's what it was then.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to the main thing. I actually think JYD is a Hall of Fame. I mean, some of my views on the Hall of Fame are a little different than others.
Yeah.
Like, I go back and forth about Sergeant Slaughter, just because, you know, if you're talking about fame, I could tell you as someone who liked Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling and wasn't really into wrestling big time until 89. Mm-hmm. Sergeant Slaughter was a major star to me as a kid watching G.I. Joe, and I knew him as Sergeant Slaughter the Wrestler. And he was a major star from, what, 81 to 85,
I would start with 80. Or you could say 79, because he was a pretty big deal as Super Destroyer Mark II in the AWA.
Right, but I try to limit it to just him being Sergeant Slaughter, because to me, that's the Hall of Fame, is that character.
Right, Super Destroyer Mark II is a good hand.
Right, right. What a great manager. Right, Lord Alfred Hayes was his manager, right?
Yes, and people don't realize just how good a manager Lord Al Hayes was.
Oh, he was great when he feuded with Heenan. I mean, that was a great stuff.
Or even the stuff in Toronto where he's feuding with Johnny Weaver. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I've never seen that.
He's just such a great, like, smug bastard. He's like, oh, no, Mr. Weaver, sir. Oh, no, you're wrong. Because he was managing, like, I just remember the way he talked. He was managing Nikolai Volkoff and Chris Markoff, who I don't know if they were working the Man Crockett territory or if they were just working Toronto, but which is weird since it was not a full-time territory. Yeah. But they had a feud with Johnny Weaver that I think was specifically on the Maple Leaf shows.
Huh. Didn't know that. But, yeah, Slaughter's run in WWF. But the Patterson match, which is considered one of the best matches in MSG history for many years.
Iron Sheik match, which was considered one of the best matches in MSG history.
Right, and that was his second run. So in between there, he goes to Mid-Atlantic, and that may be his best work ever.
And the draw is huge.
Right, remember when he had, Jim Nelson and Don Carnotal, and there was one interview, he's like, ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce you to my privates. And there's, you know, his two privates there. But that's great stuff. And then he goes back in 83, and he's still a major star, one of the most over guys there. He's coming out the theme music. He's marketed. And when he turns babyface, he was
gigantic.
Gigantic. I mean, people forget that. Hogan in 84 was the champion, and he was huge. He was the biggest star in wrestling. But he didn't feud with anyone. He would go and wrestle Big John Studd in this town and then David Schultz in this town, and that was it. And then the two touring companies – or the two touring groups of the WWF that had feuds, one was Piper and Snuka on top, and the other one was the Sheik and Slaughter. And they were huge. Slaughter was number two to Hogan. I mean, you could say Snuka, but I think Slaughter was the number two most popular guy to Hogan in 84. And it really makes you think, you know, let's say Slaughter doesn't leave in early 85. He doesn't have that dispute with Vince about merchandising. And you know, after the Sheik feud, I mean, I guess you could do Volkov, but I don't know who you'd feud him with. You got to think eventually back then, much better than it would have been in 91, they would have turned him heel and had him go against Hogan. And that would have been huge back then.
Yep.
Right? Hogan Slaughter, WrestleMania 2?
I like that. And who knows? I wonder if Slaughter can Slaughter.
Slaughter? Slaughter? The son between Slaughter and Lawler?
Sergeant Jerry Slaughter. Steve the Brawler Slaughter. Oh, yeah. Steve Lawler is now on WWE Network because I think he's in the Battle Royal on the first Best of USWA.
Oh, so we're about 2 weeks from him trying to sue for his money. The Doug Summers Act. I demand that I'm going to sue. I want some money for this.
Yeah. So what was I? Oh, so yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm sympathetic. I'm sympathetic to Slaughter and JYD, especially JYD as Hall of Famers. I really, really am.
And as a worker, I mean, we talked about it a little, but yes, after the drug problems and stuff, and after he lets himself go, I mean, he wasn't really any good. But before, I mean, he's relatively limited, being the operative word, but, I mean, yeah.
But he's always in there with great guys. I mean, let's go from WrestleMania to backwards. They put him in a feud with Terry Funk. That was probably the best guy they could have put him in a feud with.
Right.
Because Terry Funk could get a great match at any.
And he was still having good – and he would have good matches with Terry Funk.
Right. Those matches were good. Before that, you know, on Championship Wrestling for that year of 85, for the most part, he was in tag matches with Tito Santana or with this guy or that guy. So they tried to keep him in tag matches, you know, to protect him a little bit. He wrestled Greg Valentine at WrestleMania 1.
Which wasn't really a feud, though.
No. And then in 84 in Mid-South, it was him and Butch Reed – again, it was Stagger Lee and Watts against the Midnight Express again.
Kamala.
He lost. Kamala was 83. He had a little thing with Wrestling 2.
Yes, the match that killed New Orleans.
Right, the match that killed New Orleans. DiBiase and the Rat Pack. I mean, he's – I don't know. I think – you know, and again, especially with something we talked about a few weeks ago with the Carlos Colon rule, where Carlos Colon, a category was created for the Wrestling Observer Awards. So that Carlos Colon would have a fair entry because of his region.
Yes.
Why wouldn't you say the same thing about JYD? If Mid-South Wrestling, considering what a large area that was, and this is not even taking into account his outside dates and WWF. If you're just going to talk about Mid-South Wrestling, 1979 to 1984, he was the Hall of Famer from that territory. Ted DiBiase's in the Hall of Fame. JYD is the Hall of Famer for Mid-South Wrestling for those 5 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
There's different things. There's different ways of weighing things. Satoru Sayama is in the Hall of Fame, the original Tiger Mask, for a 2-year period. That's different because that's because of revolutionizing wrestling with his maneuvers and what he was doing.
Even if he wasn't that good.
I sound like Vince McMahon saying maneuvers, but.
Maneuvers.
Well. You know, I know there's that debate. We'll save that for another episode about Sayama and his place in history and how good he was or wasn't and how good those matches with Dynamite were or weren't. But he's in there for a 2-year period.
Yes.
And as we talked about previously, Ted DiBiase's in there for a give or take 10-year period of work rate. And that's really the main main attribute that caused him to be inducted in that introductory class in 1996.
Yeah.
But JYD... to me, if you have a 5-year period of being that big a star in that big an area.
Well, and also being such a transcendent cultural figure in New Orleans.
Right. I mean, they still chant, you know, the JYD chant.
Dat.
Yeah. The chant that Roddy Piper never got right when he would try to do it on his podcast. But they still chant that at New Orleans Saints games. So I don't know. I don't want to go too much further with this. I feel like the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame is going to be a regular topic because it already has. I know we've talked about Colon. We've talked about DiBiase and Wyndham and Oli. Now this. Oli. And Oli should be in the Hall of Fame too. And eventually we'll get to Terry Gordy on this list as a single. But anyway, I think that's – you have anything else you want to add to the JYD jumping off point?
No, I think I'm good with JYD, which means it's time, I think, to talk about your bar mitzvah.
Well, what would you like to know?
Well, we teased this last week.
We did. Hold on 1 second. A swig of water for the bar mitzvah boy right over here. Hold on 1 sec.
Yes. And we both just celebrated our birthdays this week, too, on the first night of Hanukkah.
It's amazing. Me and Bix have the exact same birthday, different years, but same birthday, and we're from the same hometown. I don't know. I don't know what that means.
Yes. And I remember once, I remember once you briefly experimented with making a wrestling newsletter in high school that my sister picked up off the floor and brought home.
Is that true? You got that?
Yes. Wrestling scoop sheet?
I don't think that was high school. That was middle school.
Okay, it was middle school, but...
There's no way that was high school.
Was that the name?
I don't remember that being a name, but there's a very good possibility it was because it's three words, and I don't know. I'm the type of person who would do that. Instead of just wrestling scoops or wrestling sheet, I would do wrestling scoop sheet. It sounds like something I would have done when
Pro
I was...
Pro Wrestling Torch, Wrestling Observer Newsletter, Wrestling Scoop Sheet.
Yeah, that sounds like something I would have done. I don't remember that being the name, but that sounds like something I would have done. Do you have that still? Can you burn it?
No.
Please. I guarantee whatever it was just me copying the Observer. I guarantee it.
Of course it was.
Or repeating whatever I heard on Vicious Vincent's World of Wrestling. So last week on the show, we talked about Vicious Vincent's World of Wrestling, Vince Russo's 1992 radio show out here on Long Island. And I was a big fan of it. And I was 12 years old. And I contend, and I believe, and I intend to maintain this belief, that it was actually a fun show to listen to if you were a kid who was into WWF, because there wasn't really anything else like that.
If you had never heard Pro Wrestling Spotlight.
But even if you stumbled upon John Arezzi's show, or you somehow woke up for Rich Mancuso's show, which I did many times, and boy, we need to talk about that show.
I have not heard it many times. I mean, my dad would occasionally try to record it for me.
I mean, the joke everyone would make was true, where you would call up and be like, hey, where's Bruiser Brody? Oh, he's in Japan. Like, everyone you would ask about, he would just say they were in Japan. But Vicious Vincent's World of Wrestling was a cool show to listen to if you were a kid, because John Arezzi's show was more insider and the listeners were more adults, I guess is the better word. But Vicious Vincent's show were kids calling up. So you can call up and it was cool. You know, that's where it really became cool to a lot of kids to root for the heels, because there were three hosts. It was Vicious Vincent, Skull Von Crush, later Vito LaGrasso, and the Mat Rat. And the Mat Rat was the babyface kind of dorky character. And then Vicious Vincent and Skull were kind of cool because they rooted for the heels. They loved Ric Flair. Right. I mean, it's funny, you know, considering everything that happened.
But they're friends now.
Yeah, but to get in good with Vicious Vincent back then, you would call up and go, woo! And then he would do it back at you. And then, you know, he would know that you're on the heel team.
So anyway, did you ask your parents or did your mom like broach the subject with you first, like that to book Vicious Vincent and Skull Von Crush at your bar mitzvah?
And the Mat Rat. Don't forget the Mat Rat.
Oh, so the Mat Rat was there too. I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah, he was
that.
There because there was an incident with him and Skull, which we'll get into.
Okay.
But my mother, you know, like a typical Jewish mother, she took the bar mitzvah on, you know, full blast. You know, there was, you know, a pretty large budget for that. And Jewish women like planning parties to invite, you know, everyone.
Okay, here's an aside for you. What do you remember the name of the cousin that you had never heard of before, where you first asked your parents, who the hell is this person, when they started planning?
Oh, I mean, I knew who everyone was, but it was like.
No, that was invited or that they considered inviting.
Do you know something I don't know?
No, I'm thinking in terms of my bar mitzvah, because I remember I hear my mom start talking about like an Akeem, and like my sister and I are like,
you have a cousin named Akeem?
Apparently, I have some kind of distant relative named Akeem.
Bitch, I just said bitch. Excuse me, Bix. You just became so much cooler in my eyes. You have a cousin named Akeem. Akeem Bixen's fan?
I don't think he's a Bixen's fan.
All of
the Bixen fans that we don't know personally are like either like super Orthodox or Hasidic.
Akeem Kaleidoscope? No, inside joke. Some of you may know. I kind of knew who everyone was. I did think it was preposterous, the whole idea of, you know, Mima's friends, all of them are invited. Although they were cool. They gave me large, large gifts.
Yeah.
But, you know, everyone from the office was there. Everyone from all over my universe was there. All the PTA parents my mother was in PTA with were there. And so she was really into planning it. And the first thing we did was we needed a theme. And to me, it was obvious. It was like professional wrestling is the one thing I love. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be wrestling. I had a couple of friends the year before who had bar mitzvahs and a year after. and their theme was baseball. And I was always like puzzled about that, because I was like, they don't really like baseball. Like, I like baseball, but they, you can't have a conversation with them about what's going on with their team. It was just, they had nothing they really loved, so they kind of just went with something they liked.
Well, and also the person they got the centerpiece from, the glittery, you know, centerpiece, well, had a, could make a baseball.
Well, speaking of centerpieces, so we found out from a friend of mine whose bar mitzvah was the year before, his, either his cousin or his aunt made the centerpieces. So my mother got her information, and we drove out to her place. And my mother gave her a heads up. My son likes wrestling. It's going to be a wrestling theme.
Was this, was this the woman that was called the balloon lady?
I don't know who that is.
Because I'm balloon? Just trying to think if somehow, if this was the same person we went to.
Oh, no. I don't think she was really like on the circuit. I think she kind of just did it as a hobby.
Okay.
So we went there, and she knew I liked wrestling, and she had gone to some bookstore and purchased every like old wrestling magazine she can get. And a lot of those PWIs had either full pages of, she was looking for like entire bodies, like head to toe.
Right.
And she made the coolest centerpieces ever. It was like a wrestling ring with the wrestler standing there. And then above it, it would say his name. I mean, these were the coolest things that she made. One for Lex Luger, which I remember. That was the first one she showed us, like the sample, because she didn't know who he was. And she went based on the magazine. So she spelled it Lugar, L-U-G-A-R, which it was spelled at a lot of the times in those magazines early on.
Yeah.
So we saw that, and right away I was like, yes. So I got her more, like, I picked out who I wanted, and it was like Ric Flair. Ric Flair was my table. I still have a picture of that centerpiece.
Okay, I have to see this.
Well, we'll see. Maybe I'll put it on Twitter if, like, enough people, you know, I don't know.
We can put it on Facebook.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens. If enough people express interest, I'll put it on Twitter. And then you could see the other wrestling posters that were lining my wall that year, too. So it's pretty embarrassing. You see a giant Ultimate Warrior poster.
Well, I had one. Mine was Ultimo Dragon.
In 92, you had Ultimo Dragon?
No, 96 or 97.
Oh, okay. You're talking about your bar mitzvah. I thought you were talking about just like...
No, you know, I got a bar mitzvah. No. I had one made of an Ultimo Dragon thing from the for magazine.
Okay, that's cool. But eventually I ran out of full body pictures I could find. So some of the tables, like that people I really didn't care about, like they got like Max Moon and like different people. But I had Ric Flair, and it was really, really cool. It was gorgeous. And
well, you're trying to really get over with Russo. So anyway.
Well, I love Ric Flair. He's my favorite wrestler.
I'm kidding.
So the first thought we had was, my mother said, should we get like some kind of like wrestler there? And I was like, yeah, we should get Ric Flair. So she called the WWF, and I don't know who she spoke to, but
Steve Planamenta.
Maybe Steve Placenta. And she expressed an interest in having Ric Flair. And she was, I mean, we had a pretty big budget for this thing, but she was given some price that for her was just like, it was like $10,000 to have Ric Flair come to a bar mitzvah. Let's face it. He would have come there, said something for a minute, and then been at the bar drinking and hitting on the dancers.
Well, you know what's fascinating about that, too? When Flair left WWE after the retirement to take all those outside gigs, his appearance fee was $10,000.
Was it really?
Yes.
Well, this was WWE's fee, so I'm sure they were going to take like 90% of it.
Well, I'm also surprised that they actually gave a, I'm not going to say reasonable, but a quote within the realm of possibility of someone doing it, that they were not just giving her a number to get rid of her.
No, they gave her a real number, and she can come across like a very serious woman. And she said, no, forget it, it's too much. So she said, who else? And, you know, I didn't know who else. And she's like, what about that show you listened to? How about I get in touch with them? And I was like, all right, you know, I'm not thinking anything of it. Well, like the next thing I know, I come from school and the Mat Rats in my living room. And like, this is the first time I hear the Mat Rats, like real voice. He's, you know, talking about stuff. And my mother.
Wait, did you know had you met him yet at this point? Like, was this before? So this, all right. Cause the thing, whether it was the bus trips, but the live show at Whitey Ford's Grand Slam.
I went to a bunch of those live shows at Whitey Ford's Grand Slam. I was just thinking about that the other day. Cause you know who used to be at those shows? Oh. Do you remember one of the biggest pieces of shit that was around back then? Do you remember Boss Hog Calhoun?
This would be the fake Haystacks Calhoun who sold those wrestling magazines.
He said he was the grandson.
Yes, I remember buying
the grandson of Haystacks Calhoun.
I remember buying a magazine from him at a Nerezi convention. Yes,
he would show up at these things and talk about how he was about to go into the WWF to feud with The Undertaker. And if you, until you knew he was full of shit, it made sense. It's like, wow, he's a really big fat guy. And he's the grandson of Haystacks Calhoun. Of course he would go fight The Undertaker.
Well, and he had the Haystacks Calhoun style, like, hair and facial hair, too.
He looked like Haystacks Calhoun. He's sitting at Whitey Ford's Grand Slam batting cage in overalls. I mean, he looked like Haystacks Calhoun.
Did he do the Velcro jump?
What's the... No, yeah. No, he didn't do anything except sit in a chair and drink sodas. remember, back then, Whitey Ford's Grand Slam was a sponsor on Vicious Vincent's show. Maybe one of the only ones. And it was... Go to Whitey Ford's Grand Slam and mention Vicious Vincent and get a free hot dog or a soda. And at the actual live event at Whitey Ford's Grand Slam, me and whoever I was talking to, we said, hey, let's go do that. We went up to the counter like, hi, we like a hot dog, Vicious Vincent. And they had no idea, you know, what we were talking about. It's their advertisement and he's actually there doing a live event. And they still had no idea what we were talking about. So...
I always wonder how those are supposed to work anyway, by the way, like mention XYZ.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such an uncomfortable...
So how,
you know,
yeah, so how about that Vicious Vince of World of Wrestling? How about whatever?
Vicious Vincent sent me, woo! You know, what are you supposed to say?
Well, so, wrestling fans.
So my mother somehow got in contact with them and reached some sort of agreement. So that we were going to have Vicious Vincent, the Mat Rat, and Skull Von Crush. And Skull Von Crush, excuse me. Later on, he became Skull Von Crush in Memphis, but he was actually just Skull Von Crush. And at the time, he was also doing jobs on WWF TV as Skull Von. No, as Von Crush. That was his name.
So it's like when Kevin Von Erich was in Mexico as Von Erich.
Exactly. Except he wasn't getting squashed by The Undertaker in a minute and a half.
Okay.
So... The next thing I remember from this whole thing was one day, it was like a Sunday. It was actually one of the Sundays before a live event. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, Vicious Vincent, Skull Von Crush, and the Mat Rat are in my house eating pasta with us. And my mother said to me, she goes, look, I'm going to get these guys for your bar mitzvah. Don't let them know that you know. So the entire time I had to play dumb.
Had to play dumb about why Vince Russo, the Mat Rat, and Vito LaGrasso were in your house.
Yeah, exactly. Hold on 1 second. Swig of water for Brian from Long Beach.
Okay. I'm trying to remember who else was... I don't know.
So...
That's scintillating radio, but go ahead.
So when we went to the Whitey Ford's Grand Slam, me and my friend actually rode in the car with Vito LaGrasso, Skull Von Crush.
Okay.
And I can't express enough, if you were a kid, Vicious Vincent and Skull Von Crush were so cool together. And Skull Von Crush eventually left the show when they went to 1 hour on Sundays because he couldn't do the show anymore. And that's kind of when the show dropped off. But he was so cool. And so we go to the live event, and now I know they're coming to my bar mitzvah. And now each week when I call the show, I feel a little more confident. Like, hey, Vicious Vince, let's talk about this, you know? And I get to my bar mitzvah, and at some point they pull me in the back, like to the catering area, or not catering, but the kitchen. And standing there in full gimmick is the Mat Rat, Skull Von Crush, and Vicious Vince.
Okay, now wait, get the mental image here. what fine South Shore catering hall is this?
It was a place called Montana in the in Euclid, I guess it would be.
Okay.
And I remember it specifically because like 3 months after my bar mitzvah, the mafia burned it down. And when we went there to like check out, we were checking out different places, and we went there. We went in the basement office of the guy who ran the place, and we told him it was me about wrestling. He's like, "Oh, maybe you're a big Italian guy." He's like, "Maybe you know some guys who do bodyguard work for me, the Power Twins." And I was like, "Oh, okay, yeah, I know
who are Jewish, by the way,
who are Jewish, and involved in, you know, with shady characters from Herb Abrams to the owner of Montana,
and played said shady characters in Ocean's 11."
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And what was it? Dave Power. And what was his brother's name?
Larry.
Dave and Larry Power. Yeah, anyone named Larry, you know, right away you think like, oh, he must be Jewish. So he says the Power Twins work for him. And we made a deal. And it was a really cool venue. And we went there. And so they pulled me in the kitchen. And they're all back there. And if you haven't seen Vicious Vincent and his Vicious Vincent gimmick, I'll see if I can find my autographed photo where he proclaims I'm his number one fan. And I'll see if I can scan that.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what the Vicious Vincent gimmick attire was.
Well, he had like a black cowboyish hat with like flames on it.
Okay, that's right.
And then he had like a big black leather jacket with flames. He was very into flames. Very before he burned down promotions, he was into fire. And the Mat Rat was wearing Zubaz pants with a dress shirt and tie and a do-rag to cover his bald head.
And Vito was in his gear?
Vito's gear, which is Nazi color singlet and a like Nazi-ish black leather jacket. And a Nazi-ish cap. I mean, that's without having a swastika on anything, that's really all it was Nazi-ish.
Now, do you have any relatives or attendees that were Holocaust survivors?
You know, that's a great question. Off the top of my head, I don't think so.
I'd hope not.
Yeah. I mean, you know, although to me, this is what makes me more of a Jew than you or anyone else. I had a showdown with a Nazi wrestler at my bar mitzvah. somehow that got through and was thought to be a good idea. And so they bring me in the back, and now I'm still kayfabing that I don't know these guys are there. And then I'm like, what are you guys doing here? And they're like, you know, happy bar mitzvah. Whatever they said. And the first thing that happens is they send Russo out. And he goes out there and he gets on the microphone and he goes, hi, everyone. I'm Vicious Vincent from Vicious Vincent's World of Wrestling. And I understand we have a very special occasion here today. And then the Mat Rat brings me out with his arm around me because, you know, he's like the geeky baby face. So he brings me out and I can't keep a straight face and I'm embarrassed. And I'm in front of my friends and my dad's employees and like the old women my grandmother plays gin with. Like just the weirdest bunch of people. And here I am with the Mat Rat, who on a good day you'd be embarrassed about being around. You know, again, his voice was, hey, Vicious Vince, hot diggity dog. So we're out there, and Mat Rat starts yelling at Vicious Vincent something. And then Vicious Vincent says, I have someone here who wants to meet you. And out comes Skull Von Cross. And he comes out, and he kind of just like stares over the crowd and looks over the crowd, and he gets on the mic. And probably this was probably more mic time than he got until like 1997, maybe a little bit. I don't know. I never saw an interview with him except for this for many, many years. And Skull Von Cross gets on the microphone, and before he gets to me, he decides to start walking around the room and making comments to people.
Oh boy!
Now, my dad and several of his friends are pretty big guys. My dad's like 6'4", and back then was probably like, I don't know, 280. And he certainly liked his wine and his whiskey, and so did his friends.
So Vito's actually trying to get heat.
So Vito's trying to get heat, but it's really hard to get heat against guys who are the same size as you, if not bigger, and have had some drinks. And he goes over to a few of them, and one of them, you know, is like staring him down, like, because he's had a few drinks, and he's like ready for action. And another one starts calling him out, like, you're all talk. We want to see action. We want to see you do something. We want to see action. And he goes over to my dad. And my dad, you know, I thought my dad first goes, let's go. You know, and the room popped. My dad got the big baby face reaction. And then my dad proclaimed, I'm not a fighter. I'm a lover. And Vito turned around. He called him, hey, okay, lover. And he turned back and he said, you guys want action? I'll give you action. And he walked back over to me and he got like in my face and he whispered to me, push me. So I pushed him, and now the whole room makes a reaction. And then he comes in and he goes, do it again. So I push him again, and now he picks me up over his head. And now he just kind of like walks around with me, parades me around, shows everyone that he's lifting me over his head. And then he puts me down. And then the DJ comes on, or the MC comes on and tells everyone to go to the tables and enjoy the party, and the music starts playing. So Vince Russo came up with the whole idea. It was like Vince's master plan back there. Like, here's what we'll do.
It really, but there was no ending. It's like every other Vince Russo storyline.
Yeah, they picked me up and they put me down. So then at my table, I believe we had Skull Von Cross and Vicious Vincent, and then Mat Rat was at one of the other tables, I think. And then
so he's just randomly at another table with nobody who knows him.
No, with kids. Oh, okay. They were all in the kids section.
Okay.
Because I had friends who listened to the show and they were like popping for, you know, here are these guys at this thing.
Yeah.
You know, in the video, you hear like people in the background going, woo! Like, you know, a couple of the kids knew.
I don't think you told me there was a video.
No one will ever see it ever. Ever. Never. Ever. And So then at some point during the party, I don't know what was going on, but like Skull and Mat Rat start like play, like insulting each other. And next thing I know, they're in the middle of the dance floor and the dance floor like clears out and Skull knocks Mat Rat down. And now he's got him in the position where Mat Rat's on his back and his legs are up and Skull's holding the legs, like the whole, like, I'm going to kick him in the groin thing.
Oh no.
And he's looking around the room and the kids are all going crazy. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, they're all heel fans. Obviously they're cheering for the Nazi to beat up the Mat Rat and Skull drops an elbow right to the groin. So he took an elbow bump on the hard dance floor. It wasn't like some ring. It was just the middle of the wooden dance floor.
Well, now I'm getting even more curious about the payoffs, which I guess we'll get to.
And yeah, that was that. And then that was that. And then they hung out. And, you know, this video of Vince Russo doing the electric slide and hands up.
Okay, maybe we need to see an edited version of this then.
Why, you want to see Vince Russo do hands
yes,
up?
Yes, I want to see Vince Russo doing the electric slide and hands up and just edited out everything with you.
He had a good time. He had a good time. Look, let me also say, I certainly don't like anything he's done to professional wrestling as a writer or booker or whatever, but he was always very nice to me, and, you know, I was a big fan of his show back then, and nothing could ever take that away. But with that said, I don't like anything he's done since. Vicious Vincent, to me, was the peak of his career. And so then, trying to remember what came next. They were there. They were hanging out. And then at some point, me and my friends went downstairs. And while the dancers were upstairs, we went in their bags and we stole one of their panties. And we tried to flush it down the toilet and it wouldn't go. And then we put the wet panties back in her. Yeah, I mean, typical Jewish chaos. Fun and chaos at a bar mitzvah amongst 13-year-olds.
Oh, that's and, tame compared to some bar, one bar mitzvah I went to.
Well, so afterwards, I asked my mom. My mom and me had a very open relationship. Both my parents did. I grew up in a household where, you know, if I had questions, they answered them. And I think that really benefited me. And I said, how much did you pay these guys? And she paid Vicious Vincent and the Mat Rat and Skull Von Cross $500 each, which, without question, was the biggest payday any of them have had around wrestling up to that point.
And I assume they also got a meal and access to the open bar.
Well, they got a meal and access to the open bar. I don't remember any of them drinking, to be honest. They may have, but they certainly had a meal.
So they were professional.
They were. It was cool. You know, imagine if you were a fan of a radio show or a television show, and all of a sudden the stars of the show are at your bar mitzvah. You know, you're a kid, and it's exciting. It was fun.
You had no idea, right? You didn't realize that WGBB wasn't real radio yet.
No, I thought it was real radio. I mean, other than WFAN, it was all, you know, it was the only radio I really knew at that time.
Right. I mean, I kid, but it's, you know, it was all, it's one of those stations that was all time buys.
Right. But I certainly didn't realize that back then.
Right. So, I mean, is there anything else to talk about with this or?
I don't know.
What did Jim Cornette think the first time you ever told him about this?
You know, I don't know. I was thinking that recently. I was like, I know I told him about it, but I can't remember his reaction because I probably was
Jesus Christ, Brian.
We were probably at a bar.
I can't do the Cornette voice, but all I can think of is just like him exclaiming like Jesus Christ, Brian.
Yeah, your Jim Cornette voice sounds like Jim Ross's awful Terry Funk somehow.
I didn't even try. I was just like, I know I'm not gonna do this. Cause could you imagine the damage?
Hey, you egg sucking dog. That's every time he talks about Terry Funk, that's what he does. Hey, you egg sucking dog, slow it down.
Just more like droopy than Terry Funk.
Slow it down. Yeah, I mean, his impression is the worst. It is absolutely the worst.
I hope he gets his Twitter back, though.
Who's?
Jim. JR, that's Jim.
Who took his Twitter?
It got hacked, and right now it's temporarily gone. I guess temporarily.
Was it Tony Schiavone?
Not that I know. It was an angry British football fan or something. Soccer football.
Oh. Okay. Well, but yeah, that's the bar mitzvah story, the best that I remember off the top of my head. Like I said, if enough people want to see it, I'll post the centerpiece of Ric Flair that was on my table and maybe the Vicious Vincent autograph photo I have somewhere.
So was this photo, did he have professionally done 8x10s?
Oh, yeah. My family made them because my family was in the printing. Yeah. Okay. So going into the bar mitzvah, we wanted things for him to sign for people. So we made the photos for him and the Mat Rat, And I mean, it was what they ended up using going forward after that. Although his show really didn't last too much longer. It was only on a few more months. But yeah, my family printed those for him.
Wow.
Because we needed something. We needed something for him to sign. He didn't have anything. He had photos, but he didn't have anything printed out. And my family owned the largest commercial printing company in New York City, so it was pretty easy to do.
Now,
one time, slightly off topic, we'll return to it. I was at some convention with Georgie Amacropoulos. Not a wrestling convention, just like a general collectibles memorabilia convention. And every now and then there'd be wrestling people there. Missy Hyatt was there. And I got to talking to her, and she was letting me know that she wanted to do a calendar. I was like, oh, you should call my dad and talk to him. We're in the printing business. We can help you out if you know what you're doing. She said, oh, great. And she called him up like a
– Wait, so is this the convention I was talking about that you didn't realize was an Aregi convention?
No. This was like
had the Aregi affiliation?
No, this was in New Jersey somewhere.
Okay. Chiller Theater or something maybe?
It wasn't Chiller Theater. It was just some like card convention. It was like cards and Beatles stuff. And it was like a weird little convention. Yeah. It was cool. And she called my dad, and I asked my dad, I was like, what happened? Did you make a deal? Because I'm thinking, I'll get free Missy Hyatt calendars. I'll be the greatest. And he's like, yeah, she really didn't know what the hell she wanted or what she was talking about. So the other story with my dad, now I'm going to tell my stories about my dad because I know he doesn't listen, is I was at a convention at Hofstra in 94, I think. Could have been 95. I think it was 94. And Bret Hart was there. And I started talking to Bret on his way out. And I was like, hey, I'm from Long Beach. And he goes, oh, that's where my parents, met. That's where my mother's from. So I knew I had an easy connection there.
Right.
And I said, I just was watching footage. I got a 1979 Georgia with your on it. And he's like, oh, I would really love to see that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, let me know how I can get it to you. And he said, okay, give me your phone number. I said, okay, here you go. He was one of my favorite wrestlers. So I gave it to him. And I went home and I sat by the phone just waiting for Bret to call, and he never called. And then the next day I went to school, and when I came home, there was something written on like a pad next to my bed, and it was just this ad. It was like Bret Hart, care of
Marcy Engelstein.
Care of Marcy Engelstein. And then it was this Canadian address that my dad clearly just jotted something down. I don't know what he wrote. He didn't remember what he wrote. So he was like, I don't know. I just wrote what she told me. But as soon as I went to school, my dad answered my phone, and it was Bret Hart. Like, hey.
Oh, it was Bret? It was Bret. It wasn't Marcy.
No. It was Bret. He said, this is where you can get me stuff. And he gave us Marcy's address.
And the address, though, you couldn't figure it out, so you never sent it.
It was, not that Canadian addresses are so difficult, but it was just.
Well, the zip codes are a little weird.
It was the zip code. It was everything. It was just, I don't know what my dad wrote. But yeah.
So, yeah, good times. And the bar mitzvah is in Vince Russo's book. I mean, not in detail, but it is.
He just mentions you went to a fan's bar mitzvah.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, yeah, I'm trying to remember if he says it was a paid booking or not. If he refers to it as one. I think he does say that we worked a kid's bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
Something like that. So
that was mine. Little did he know that a few years later I'd be buddies with Cornette at Fan Week.
Yeah, 2 years later. Yeah, less than 2 years later.
That's right.
Well, Cornette didn't know hair nor hide of him at that point.
That's right. That's right.
Although they got along at first.
When I went on the Vicious Vincent bus trip to Halloween Havoc 92 in Philadelphia, when we were leaving the arena, we had our crew getting ready to go on our bus. And all of a sudden you just start hearing this chant, Russo sucks. Russo sucks. And we're all looking around and it was John Arezzi and his whole bus trip. And I didn't know anything about the feud or anything, but it was the first time I ever heard Russo sucks chanted. And it was outside the arena, and he wasn't, he was just a radio show host.
But it's been very confusing, too, because you were in Philly.
Right.
You were in New York. You were in Philly, and all of a sudden, Russo sucks.
In Philly, at that awful Halloween Havoc pay-per-view. The highlight of it for me was I got a Steiner Brothers shirt, and they weren't even on the show.
Do you still have it?
Yes.
Those WCW shirts go for a lot of money.
Yeah, I don't know what kind of condition it's in, but I still have it.
I guess.
But anyway.
Yeah, so speaking of people who love Vince Russo, I did not listen to it yet, but you wanted to talk a little about, I guess, again, it's just a jumping off point. Yes, this has been more of a formatted show so far than the first two, and probably than most will be.
Well, it'll be easier for you to timestamp for the man who
I'm not doing timestamps.
Oh, okay.
But Jeff, I keep mixing the two of them up for some reason.
No, Harry one Harris, has talent. One has talent, and the other one's his son.
Well, Jeff was a good wrestler.
Yeah, he was all right.
He was a good wrestler until he turned heel.
He was all right. I'll give you that, and I won't go.
Okay, so Jerry Jarrett was on Cornette's podcast.
What a great episode. Okay. You know, I know some – I read a couple of reviews where people said, it was all right. It may have been the best wrestling podcast interview I've heard.
Really?
Jerry Jarrett was – he was amazing. He was talking about everything I would want to hear about. He was talking about his version of the Atlanta – of the Atlanta Wrestling War, where he took over when they went to war with Ann Gunkel. He talked about dealings with Jim Barnett. He talked about his relationship with Vince McMahon Sr. He talked about his relationship with Vince McMahon Jr. He talked about Vince Russo, obviously. It was – and Jim Cornette – and I mean he talked about other things too, but Jim Cornette was the perfect guy to interview Jerry Jarrett because he knew exactly where to kind of nudge him and exactly what to ask. And he said that there's going to be a part two where they'll talk more about other things like the Nick Goulas, 1977 breakup. But it – Bix, I was shocked when you told me you hadn't listened to it because it's right down your alley. If you like Memphis, and we love Memphis, I thought it was the best wrestling podcast interview I've heard.
I will definitely listen to it then. Like I was telling you before we started recording, because I'm not a fan of his book. So when I saw that Joe Gagné, who I'm usually pretty in sync with, was not crazy about it. I mean, he didn't dislike it, but he felt it was kind of thumbs in the middle. It wasn't like I wasn't going to listen to it, but I just put it on the back burners. But now, with your recommendation, I'm definitely going to listen to it.
It was – I thought I was so – I may listen to it again, quite frankly. It was
really?
So, yeah. And I also thought it was – how do I put this? It was the most interesting and obviously educated take on Vince McMahon Jr., on Vincent K. McMahon, that I've heard. Because he certainly
– I love you that you corrected yourself as if he's listening.
Well, Jerry said, and I thought this was fascinating. He goes, Vince is an emotional slob.
Okay.
It's like, wow. And it's a fascinating, fascinating interview. You know, I had actually had a thought recently about Memphis. Mm-hmm. I love Memphis wrestling. I love any 80s Memphis wrestling, 70s Memphis wrestling, I love. And while there's stuff post 89 that I really, really like, Eddie Gilbert, Smoky Mountain feud,
Moondogs.
Yeah, there's Vince. Lots.
Yeah,
there's lots of really good stuff. I gotta say, I don't enjoy, and this is a weird thing, but I like it so much better when the studio had curtains than when it just had like the black wall and the desk in front of it.
Well, and also when they sort of tried to decorate the studio up a little bit more with the stars and stripes kind of motif.
Yeah, I mean, and
I didn't really
it looked so much cooler back then. Now, that's the only thing I really don't like about 90s Memphis is just the studio looks awful to me.
Yeah, they clearly thought it looked great and upgraded, but it didn't look good.
No, I mean, there was, there's sometimes just because something's a classic look and something's been around for a long time, you don't have to change it.
Yeah, I did not like either when they did the I like that they did the thing where the angle where the set got torn down with Kurt Hennig, although which is obviously inspired by the angle where the set got knocked down on Continental a few weeks earlier. But I didn't like the way that the show looked after that.
No, I completely agree.
And then the way I guess I'm trying to
a minute. But in 89, like when Ricky Morton was there as a heel
with the weird like spray painted looking. Or whatever it was supposed to be version of the CWA set.
But they were still doing interviews in front of the green curtain.
Yes.
See, so it sort of still resembled early 80s Memphis in that way. But after that, they got rid of the curtain.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know what, 90, like 91, like I'm trying to think. When they really started adding like the weird lighting is when I thought it was just like the point of no return. I thought it still looked okay like before that.
And then... And was it 93 or 92 when they added the green screen local interviews?
Oh, God. That was not good. Territories and technology. Not a good mix.
That's a great topic right there.
Okay, let's do that then. We'll, we can get back to Memphis in a bit. So, like, one of the things that comes to mind when I think of that is, you know how the Open for Southeastern Championship Wrestling talked about how they were, like, voted the best wrestling television show in the nation because of their innovative use of instant replay and whatever?
Yeah, voted that by Ron Fuller himself.
I'm trying to remember, what did they say it was, like the wrestling press or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Which I'm guessing is, and I like Liz Thatcher, but I'm guessing that was a Liz Thatcher idea to put over the things that Liz Thatcher came up with for the TV show.
Yeah, that's right. And may have been his publishing empire.
Because, I mean, he really did do a good job with producing those shows and... Like, because the way he did, would do the personality profile stuff, and they tried to do some other stuff with the graphics. I mean, and he was a good announcer.
He was doing a lot of stuff. I recently sold on eBay an old WWWF magazine from, like, 1980. Or maybe WWWF by that point, actually.
Right, and he was the editor of some of the programs. Yeah, and he
was the publisher, I believe, of the program.
So was that – did they stop using Norm Keitzer briefly and then went with him and then went back to Norm?
I'm not sure. Let me see if I actually have it right here on my computer. Let me
Oh, yes, because you scan these. And...
Oh, I scan everything, man.
You've scanned them, but you have not shared them with me.
No, I haven't yet. I'm very selfish. Admittedly, I'm very, very selfish. Let's see. WWF Wrestling Action Stars of the 80s, Volume 1, Number 5. And let's see. From our staff. Well... And then the page goes flying. The hell's going on here? Bear with me. This thing's going to be problems. Okay. Let's see. Wrestling Action staff, writers and photographers, Fred Durabice, Larry Dwyer, Michael Frias, David Rubenstein, Vito Shippa, and Al Testore. I don't know any.
Larry Dwyer is the only name I ever recall hearing before.
Art director, Cal Byers.
I have no idea who any of these people are.
Publisher, Les Thatcher. Published by LT and Associates, Knoxville, Tennessee.
Oh, I wonder who that is.
And then address all comments, ideas, opinions, and questions to WWF Wrestling Action Magazine, GPO Box 1256, New York, New York, 10001.
Huh.
So I wonder whose PO Box that was. Oh, here's a interesting article. As I See It by Vince McMahon. The staff of WWF Wrestling Action Magazine.
Which Vince McMahon?
It doesn't say.
No photo. I guess it's supposed to be Junior.
I guess.
Because he's the announcer.
The staff of WWF Wrestling Action Magazine. First of all, it says WWF here. It says it on the cover, and it says address all comments, ideas, opinions, and questions to WWF.
What year is this? Action. Well, this is already – it's already at least 1980.
It's 1980.
So they've been WWF for a little while.
Yeah. Well, I guess LT and Associates dropped the ball on that.
Mm.
Anyway, the staff of WWF Wrestling Action Magazine has asked me to comment on the controversy involving Bruno Sammartino and Larry Zbyszko. Zbyszko spelled Z-Y-B-S-C-K-O.
Well, actually, close enough.
Actually, I think it's a disgrace the way Larry Zbyszko viciously turned on Bruno Sammartino during the championship wrestling program. I don't know how anyone could pull such a low-down, sneaky stunt. But in my years as commentator, I've witnessed quite a few unbelievable incidents. However, this has to be the worst. I sincerely feel that Larry Zbyszko will get what is coming to him. Through the years, Bruno Sammartino has been a true credit to the profession. He has defeated every top wrestler in the sport, and I have to feel that Larry Zbyszko will meet the same fate as all of Bruno's previous opponents. Bruno Sammartino, as I see it, will once again emerge triumphant, and Larry Zbyszko, the former good guy, will definitely get what he asked for.
Okay. That sounds like every... other magazine thing that's clearly not written by the person that said it was by.
An important note to our subscribers. Due to unexpected circumstances, we have been unable to publish Wrestling Action on a bi-monthly basis. we regret any inconvenience this may have caused you. However, we will be publishing the balance of your subscription and subsequent issues in the future. Once again, thank you for your loyal support, and we will continue to deliver you the finest wrestling publication on the market today.
I guess we know why they went back to Norm Keitzer.
Special attraction, full-color pinup of Pat Patterson and Bob Backlund.
Not much to say about that.
All right, here are the headlines. Okay. Everyone is wild about Tito Santana and Ivan Putski. Hulk Hogan, a perfect 10.
Well, he resembles Baby Doll in a few ways.
Or Bo Derek. Will the Samoans capture the tag team title?
Yes.
Rene Goulet, versatile and talented.
No.
Can Ken Patera win the belt this time?
No.
How long can Bob Backlund stay on top?
3 years.
Can Tony Atlas achieve superstardom in the 80s?
No, because feet.
Who is the real living legend? Has Pat Patterson changed his evil ways?
Yes. Not if you ask Murray Hodgson.
Hey. Well, I mean, that was a long time ago by this point.
God. Ah, wrestling magazines.
It was a good quality magazine, like good stock of paper.
And he, like, did it have, what's the cover?
The cover, hold on, let me see if I can actually get back to the top. I don't know why.
Is it like one of those, like watercolor covers?
It's a watercolor cover of, like, stars coming out of the sky, and it's Hogan, Putski, Backlund, Tony Atlas, Tito Santana, Ken Patera.
And those were all Les's, right?
It looks kind of cool, except for the Ivan Putski one, which looks like it's out of Blue Boy magazine. You got to see this thing.
Is this when? Wait, is this Putski? This is clean shave. Is this clean shaven Putski?
It's clean shaven Putski, but you got to see the pose they have him in here.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's this. Wrestling action.
So were we talking about Memphis anywhere, or should we move on to...
Let's move on.
Move on to Body Slam, because you said you rewatched Body Slam recently.
I rewatched Body Slam recently. I always loved that movie. That movie was on HBO a lot when I was a kid.
It was on HBO a lot. It would be on in syndication.
Oh, it was Body Slam, Just One of the Guys, The Last Dragon. I mean, these were always on. And Body Slam, I always loved. And I haven't watched it in a long time. And now Roddy Piper is dead. So let me watch this again. And my first thought is, I'm convinced M. Harry Smilak is one of the greatest characters of all time. He's so good as like the scummy babyface manager. And the band Kick, who were Kicks, but he got rid of the S. Yeah. I just downloaded the soundtrack and I got all their songs.
Where did you get the soundtrack?
I found it on some bootleg site. It's the American Way. And what was the other one?
I just remember American Way.
Yeah.
You have to send me that immediately.
I remember the American Way because that's when The Barbarian and T-Joe Khan, what were their names? Axe and Hammer?
Yes, Axe and Hammer.
The Cannibals. They storm the ring, and they start destroying their stuff, and T-Joe Khan turns to one guy, and he goes, "Your guitar needs tuning." And he just starts breaking the guitar. And Captain Lou Albano, if you haven't seen this movie, please go out of your way to watch it. It's definitely on YouTube, like the whole thing. Okay. Captain Lou Albano plays the character Captain Lou Morano.
Okay, so let's dissect this for a second, because this is what's always confused me about this movie. Everyone else is a character. I mean, except for your brief cameos at the big climactic match.
And that's great, and we have to get to that, yes.
Wait, right, but so why is Lou Albano, Captain Lou Morano, who is in every way Captain Lou Albano, except for that his name is Captain Lou Morano?
It's really ridiculous. He's dressed like Captain Lou Albano. He acts and talks like Captain Lou Albano, but his name is Captain Lou Morano. Maybe Vince owned the rights to the name by that point and Lou Albano couldn't use it. Who knows?
I don't think so.
Well, anyway, in case you haven't seen it, Body Slam is the tender story of a young man named M. Harry Smilak.
And it's a very gratuitous, just before we get out of the way, I mean, it was implied earlier, it's the most obvious exploitation of the rock and wrestling thing, about 2.5 years too late.
Well, that's the thing that I find fascinating about it, is that obviously it was written when the wrestling boom started, because there's a show based on TNT, there's a tag team based on the Road Warriors, rock and wrestling is a big part of it, although rock and wrestling...
M. Harry Smilak invents it.
Yeah, but it was rock and wrestling in reality was never presented in any way the way it was here.
This.
No, where basically they have shows where the band plays and then there's one match right. where it's Slick Rick Roberts and Tonga Tom against local kids in the place. Most of them played by South California indie workers like Billy Anderson. And
of course, and Alexis Smirnoff's in it, right?
Alexis Smirnoff plays Captain Lou Morano's wrestler when M. Harry Smilak has the revelation that Quick Rick Roberts is not a musician, but he's a professional wrestler.
Right. Wild Samoans are the Korean guy's henchmen.
They are the bodyguards for the Korean guy. Yes.
Yes, the Korean guy who M. Harry Smilak repeatedly insults by calling Chinese or Japanese.
Yeah. That's right.
And then when he corrects him and says, "I'm Korean," he says something like, "Ah, yes, the Three Orientals."
I don't remember that line, actually. And so basically, M. Harry Smilak's a music manager, and he's not doing very well, and he owes money all over town, and he's kind of a con artist, and his car is constantly being repossessed by someone. The guy who repossesses the car a couple times in the movie is a guy who, during the main event, is like dancing in the crowd with some girl, which I find really funny for some reason. He's waiting to repossess his car again, and he just starts dancing when the music starts playing. And Harry Smilak is trying to book something somewhere, and he goes into the office of the guy who runs the arena, and the guy keeps kicking him out. He's having a meeting with someone, and it's Roddy Piper as Quick Rick Roberts. And I got to say, I mean, look, it's not Citizen Kane, but Roddy Piper's really good in this movie as Quick Rick Roberts. He's totally like believable as this nice babyface who has a niece who's his agent.
But who's doing the single parent thing? And
well, it's his niece. It's not even a parent.
Well, it's his niece, but he's clearly her guardian.
Right, right. And so Harry hears Quick Rick saying that they sell out the arena all the time, and he storms into the office and he says, "Oh, you need a manager." And now he ends up managing him, and that's his first run-in with Captain Lou Morano. So now he knows
because Captain Lou Morano was Quick Rick Roberts' manager.
According to this movie, like, Captain Lou Morano is the manager of every wrestler who makes money.
Well, because he eventually has them blackballed.
Right. Because Captain Lou Morano has all the power in this universe of Body Slam. And then Quick Rick Roberts, without even having a match yet, is so in love with M. Harry Smilak as his manager that he recommends him to his friend Tonga Tom, who's played by the Tonga Kid, who had just a year and a half earlier had a major feud with Roddy Piper. So it's funny to see Sam Fatu in this role.
Yes.
And again, he's really good in the role, too. I mean, it's really weird.
And this is the only acting job I ever remember for him.
Right. And maybe my favorite scene in the movie. There's a few that may be my favorite.
Yeah.
But so he gets Tonga Tom, and then all of a sudden these two guys come over, the Cannibals, obviously written to be based on the Road Warriors. It's the Barbarian and Tejo Khan.
Now, what year was this shot?
Well, Piper's in it, so...
Is this during the initial hiatus?
Wait, it must have been during...
And then, when was They Live, though?
They Live was after WrestleMania 3.
So this was shot during his 86. Hiatus.
Let's say 86 then.
Before he came back. The hiatus that set up the flower shop. I guess. Okay.
I think that's the only thing that makes any sense. It's funny now that you say that. Was Lou Albano gone that same time? Maybe.
It's so hard to keep track of when Lou Albano was around and not around during that period.
So... The Cannibals come over and they threaten M. Harry Smilak and eventually...
Well, also, by the way, was Tejo Khan anything at this point?
I was just thinking that. I don't think so, but I don't know.
Was he a wrestler yet? Was he an actor that ended up becoming a wrestler?
These are all questions that, you know, Tejo Khan's going to become our next LP Bay Diaz, where all of a sudden we get answers from all over the world.
Okay.
So they scare off the Cannibals, Quick Rick does, and they do this great scene. This is my favorite part. Where they walk away laughing and they have their arms around each other's shoulders. And it's just, you never see anyone in the gym do this. They're just holding each other, walking away like, ha 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 ha, like this fake laugh.
It was like the end of an episode of Speed Racer.
Yeah, it's so silly. And then they start wrestling. And then eventually M. Harry Smilak has the epiphany that if he combines his failing rock band kicks with his wrestlers who are blackballed, he could start rock and wrestling, going on tour with it. Well, before this, I should talk about they have like this TNT show, the Vic Carson
Ring Talk.
Ring Talk with Vic Carson, because they go, "Oh, you got to go on Carson." He goes, "Oh, you mean Johnny Carson?" They're like, "No, Vic Carson," and it's played by Charles Nelson Reilly,
which I also think they say is the highest rated show on television.
It's the highest rated show on television, and it certainly makes – based on the audience in the set –
it's every pro wrestling fan stereotype you've ever seen.
It's every stereotype you've ever seen, you know. And the other interesting thing about the movie, which is why I couldn't show the kids, is that on the set of Ring Talk, they have Vic Carson brings out three guests. It's M. Harry Smilak, Captain Lou Morano, and I forget the name of the dwarf manager.
It's Billy Barty.
But what's his name is the character?
I don't remember.
But he just says the word faggot over and over and over
again.
Yes,
he just keeps calling Harry Smilak one.
Right. So that was why I couldn't show the kids the movie. And eventually they beat up M. Harry Smilak. And they go on the road with the rock and wrestling thing, and they start challenging people in different parts of the town, and they start getting popular.
Yes, there are see, even though pro wrestling's a shoot, they still sort of imply that these challenge matches or exhibition matches is Emma Harry Smilak calls them, are kind of more of a shoot in a way, like, because they're challenging fans out of the crowd, and you've got your hillbillies, where it's the skinny guy and the fat guy, whatever. I mean,
they were brothers. The skinny guy and the fat guy are brothers, and they not only get beat, but they're so happy to get beat, they shake hands right away and they hug, and then later on for the main event, they're also in the crowd dancing when the band's playing. And I guess to go to the main event, the whole movie's building up, and the wrestlers you see are Alexis Smirnoff, Roddy Piper, Tonga Kid, Tejo Khan, Barbarian, and then various other people as incidental jobbers.
Rock and Wrestling, or their version of Rock and Wrestling. Do they call it Rock and Wrestling?
They call it Rock and Wrestling, and it gets on the cover of Rolling Stone.
That's what I was going to say. It cuts on the cover of Rolling Stone. So I guess Rock and Wrestling was not trademarked the way they used it.
It definitely was, because if you watch any of the Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling, it'll say Rock and Wrestling is a trademark by Cyndi Lauper and Dave Wolf.
Okay.
So I don't know. But again,
maybe Cyndi Lauper Rock and Wrestling is trademarked, but Rock and Wrestling was not.
I don't know.
So the main event.
So they go to the main event, and
very obviously shot at the Olympic Auditorium, of course.
Yes, and they start introducing the luminaries. Out of nowhere, they go, ladies and gentlemen, the NWA World Champion, Ric Flair. And all of a sudden, Ric Flair's there.
And it's Jimmy Lennon as the ring announcer, right?
No.
It's not? No, wait, who is it? I'm trying to remember. No, you're right. Okay, it wasn't Jimmy Lennon.
I don't remember, but it's definitely not Jimmy.
It's not any kind of recognizable ring announcer, then.
No.
I don't think.
They introduce Ric Flair. And then they introduce Sheik Adnan El-Casey and Fred Blassie, who are sitting next to each other. They're such bad heels that they enjoy each other's company. I guess Blassie has a good relationship with Sheiks of all kinds.
And then Bruno Sammartino.
And then Bruno. I don't know. And Bruno's working for the WWF at this time. He's a commentator. And Bruno does what he does every time, and it makes me laugh so much. He stands, they announce him, he gets a big pop, he stands up, and he does, I don't even know how to describe it, he just picks his arms up. It's like a two-handed, like, wave thing that he always does, you know? He picks his hands up, and he just kind of, like, acknowledges, like, yes, I'm humble, but I know that I'm the greatest, and you all love me, yes. And eventually a brawl breaks out in the crowd, and Bruno, and by the way, Bruno had some kind of date in the movie. There was no woman like hanging out with Ric Flair. Although one of the great things is when the band's playing, they go to a shot of Ric Flair and he's like clapping along to the music.
Isn't Bruno dancing to the music too?
Bruno, of course he is, but Bruno has experience dancing from those Bally's commercials. And which whoever does the playlist for this radio show, make sure you include Bruno dancing in those Bally commercials. Because not only does he dance with all the sports celebrities, he's front and center. And he's smiling, and he's really into it. And that may be the first thing Bruno did without his wig. So, but anyway.
Yeah, you might be right. What year? Because it was like late 70s, early 80s, right?
No, it was it was definitely early 80s. It was probably, I want to say,
post-retirement, pre-return as an announcer. So, yeah.
82 to 84, somewhere in there. But body slam. And then eventually, Quick Rick Roberts and Tonga Tom win the tag team titles, and that's the end of the movie.
After the, I think they call it a double bulldog, and they act like it's a big innovative move, but it's actually the two of them bulldogging the other guys at the same time, just independently of each other.
Hey, when I was a kid, I thought the body slam was a big move because of this movie and because Hogan body slam Andre.
Oh, okay.
I was like, wow, a body slam. Whoa. And then I realized I could do it to my sister. I was like, yeah, I guess it's not that big.
Well, they made a movie about it. It's got to be good.
Yeah.
Or named body after it.
M. Harry Smilak. That guy's so good.
Dirk Benedict. Dirk Benedict, yeah.
He was on A-Team with Mr. T. You think T told him, he's like, watch out for that Piper. He's a motherfucker. Watch out for him. He don't like my mama. Watch out for Roddy Piper.
No, I don't think so.
You don't think so? So, T, I'm doing a movie with Rowdy Roddy Piper. He's a fool. He stiffed me. By the way, I watched Rocky 3 on TV the other day. There was a Rocky marathon on Thanksgiving. And it's funny because so many people complained about the WrestleMania 2 boxing match with Roddy Piper. But in Rocky 3, in the second match with Rocky, when Rocky finally gets his comeback, Mr. T also is like blown up by the second round. Like, that's like in the movie, he's like out of breath and blown up by the second round. So it's not like it just happened at WrestleMania 2. Even in the movie he was in, he's blown up in the second round.
And you would think they would be able to get around it in that.
Yeah. What a great heel he is in that movie.
Oh, the all-time, the great part, the best part is, I remember.
Hey, woman.
Yes.
Hey, woman.
If you want to be with a real man, you come down to my apartment right now, or tonight, or whatever it is.
Yeah. That line's great, and the other line I love is, yes, Thunderlips is here, in the flesh, baby. It's just so ridiculous.
Yeah, and that Hogan did. Do you know about the thing Hogan did to promote this? The magazine shoot?
For Wii Magazine?
Yes.
Yes, I've seen the pictures of that.
I've only seen the censored version that were in the tabloids later
I've seen the uncensored version.
Okay. I don't. Yeah. Well, so, you know.
It wasn't anything. It wasn't especially scandalous. It was just a couple of naked
women pressed against
his body.
Well, the thing that's funny, though, is like Gawker and preparing their like elaborate, you know, defense or statement of facts or whatever in the lawsuit that Hogan has against them. You know, their strategies that they're trying to portray it as, you know, Hogan made his sex life a big part of his public persona. So that made the publishing the sex tape clips newsworthy and so on and so forth.
That's so silly.
Okay, but they file, you know, various exhibits, one of which was the Wii photo spread, which I presume for no other reason than the judge agreed with him it would be embarrassing, is sealed.
Huh. That's really weird.
Yeah, it's so stupid.
It's sealed unless you go to Google and search for it. Otherwise, it's sealed.
Yeah. I mean, there are public articles that are sealed, but I think that's more about the context of what's being, like, why they're an exhibit. Like, if it's something that's otherwise sealed or whatever, but yeah. And he, like, what was it? Was it in that? Yeah, he talked, where maybe in that deposition where he talks about how it's like this thing at Stallone's house and like he didn't know what was going to happen or what, you know, just some sort of bullshit. Or maybe it was in his book, one of his books.
You just show up at Stallone's house and his women naked ready for a photo shoot?
Yeah.
I want to go to Stallone's house. You knocked him down. Why don't you try knocking me down now? That's another one of my favorite Rocky lines from Rocky 4. Rocky 5, actually, yeah.
Yeah, why couldn't Mr. T just, like, I get that he didn't want to spar, but why couldn't he just, like, do something with the gloves on so he wouldn't blow up?
You know, I don't know.
I get why he was worried that he was worried someone would try to show him up and it would get out and blah, blah, blah. I get the concern. But then he just blows up during the match because he can't hold his hands up.
I don't know what was going through T's head at the time. Probably his mama.
His brothers weren't rapists.
That's right. That was another thing from that. Someone needs to get that script, that whole script, and release it somewhere so we get to see what he didn't say.
What do you mean? He had his Hall of Fame speech. He had no. Why? He had a whole thing.
Right? Oh, maybe he didn't. I don't remember actually.
Well, I'm guessing WWE didn't script it for him, and then I thought WWE. I know it was really long, but I thought WWE missed out on a big opportunity by not like just releasing the whole thing for free on YouTube the next day.
It was really long. He was a lot more exciting than Alita. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, or making some kind of video though out of it that would be on YouTube, some more extensive video that could be like, I think they would have had like a big viral video if they had figured out the right way to edit it.
And WWE could screw up a one car funeral.
I've never heard that one before.
Yeah.
Wait, explain this to me. A procession. Okay.
They could screw up the simplest things. They dropped the ball and missed the ball on so many things. It's not a new thing. It's years and years and years. It used to just be they would screw up bringing in wrestlers who were stars somewhere else.
Yes.
And then it just became they screw up every opportunity to have an opportunity.
Yes. Now, I have a theory on something. I guess we'll finish up on this because I think we're at about our time. But I think Vince just never had a good handle on a top babyface who didn't fit into his just general idea and archetype of the WWF or WWF top babyface. Because it's not like, I think at first glance, it's more edgy guys. And sometimes there are exceptions. Austin, I'd say to an extent, Savage. But if you think about it, like, I just think with Roman Reigns, it's kind of the same way he ruined Diesel.
Yeah.
And then Shawn Michaels.
Very much the same way Rune Diesel, actually.
Yeah. Shawn Michaels, he clearly had no idea how to book a heartthrob babyface or a blowjob babyface or whatever you want to call him. Because he had the whole thing with the announcers fawning over him like they were in love with him.
That was unwatchable. You know, I'm sorry. It was unwatchable, that stuff. As good as Shawn was in the ring, it was unbearable. And all the merchandise was kind of like, you know, out of a S&M club or something. You know?
And I mean, you have your exceptions. You have your Austin and Rock, who could have gotten, you know, Austin, Rock, and Savage
forget about Savage. Austin and Rock was the period of time where Vince was most susceptible to change and doing something different and trying hard because he was actually worried about WCW.
Yeah.
He had his boogeyman of Ted Turner, which, you know, Ted Turner has never thought 2 seconds about Vince McMahon, but he had his boogeyman of Ted Turner and he was frightened and he was willing to go outside of his normal box. But that's why WWF now is booked just like WWF in 1995 in so many ways.
Right.
A mid-card no one cares about. A baby face is being pushed in a manner that no one would ever root for him. Like even Cena for so many years, I always argued that Cena was the heel. You know, everyone's like, oh, they should turn him heel. He is the heel.
Well, it got to the point where it didn't matter.
He is the heel. He's a 40-year-old man dressed like a 12-year-old who condescends. He's the heel.
And cuckolded his best friend, not Dolph Ziggler, Zack Ryder.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that.
Okay.
I was still trying to watch it.
I still can't believe they did that, because I don't understand how you do that and not understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
Unless they did. Unless it was like, you know what, we don't care. He's going to get cheered and booed by the same people anyway. We don't like Zack Ryder, so we're going to have John Cena cuckold him.
The problem is there's not one person in that company, from the wrestlers to the staff to the children, who are just willing to say, you know, Dad, you know, Vince, we'd probably have a better chance of catching a contemporary audience if you would just stay home. You know, I know you like working. You want to work until you die. I mean, Vince always said he wanted to work until he died and never wanted to give it up. This is Vince at 70. What's Vince at 80 going to be like? The show's going to be the worst thing of all time. It's bad now. Imagine 80-year-old Vince trying to create his next Diesel.
Well, now that he's 70, are we just assuming he's never going to die?
I'm not assuming he's never going to die, but I'm assuming if he does live another 15 years,
he's going to live a very long life.
It's going to be impossible to force him out unless the shareholders act up, and the shareholders don't have enough power because of the way the stock is structured.
Right. A lot of people don't realize this, that that the McMahons really own the majority no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's why it's an awful stock to have. That and the fact that, I mean, they just don't know what they're doing.
Well,
I mean,
it's a good stock to have if you're just buying it to sell quickly and you follow, you know, and you read The Observer.
Yeah, but even if you read The Observer, you'll find that it goes up at times where you're like, how could it possibly go up? And it goes down at times where you're like, oh, things are looking up. I mean, there really isn't a rhyme and a reason to that stock.
Well, if you figure out, like, what kind of bullshit that they'll buy into, though.
Eh, I don't know. I've thought of it that way, and I considered buying it in the past because it used to have a really high dividend, which I like.
It's been a little less predictable the last like nine months, year or so.
Yeah,
but it's like I think he just doesn't have a good handle on baby faces who are not just our superhero, you know, conquering the monster who I'm having a 3-month program with.
I don't think he has a good concept of society and what society. Yes. Where society is right now, what we want and what we root for and what we pay to see and what we are interested in watching every week. He has no idea. Even if you're going to do a 3-hour Raw, I mean, I hate to talk about contemporary wrestling right here, and we'll end on this, but even if you're going to do a 3-hour Raw, change the format. The format's tired and stale and old. You could even if you want to do some squash matches, or even if you don't want to do squash matches, you just want to do like main event matches or, you know, mid-card versus mid-card matches. Mix up the show. You know, that was that one show where I did watch where after the Royal Rumble, I want to say, there was a snowstorm and they had to shoot the show from the studio in Connecticut. And it was the most like a UFC show that I've ever seen in terms of it was like sit down interviews and no one was as scripted, or at least it didn't appear as scripted. Like, that's the kind of stuff you could do. Build up stuff by showing personalities. I mean, the scripting's a big problem. It's just, it's never going to be a good thing. It's always going to be bad. And it's not conducive towards making these guys better performers in any possible way. But change up the format just so it's not the same thing. And kill the announcers. Don't get rid of them. Kill them. But anyway.
I think Corey Graves, I think he's doing a good enough job on NXT that I think he would be good on the main show. As long, you know, obviously if he's not being produced to death by Vince, which is...
Anyone who's WWF-ized in that system is awful. And Corey Graves, I don't think he's that good. He may be the best of what they have, but I don't think he's that good, and I don't want to see him because I hate those neck tattoos. That's me being superficial, but whatever. He looks ridiculous. He looks like a wimpy guy with neck tattoos. It's ridiculous.
He looks like their version of proving CM Punk wrong.
Yeah, it looks like CM Punk's number one fan is what it looks like.
Well, there's a great... the time when me and Naylor did the podcast with Punk, which was, Jesus, 8 years ago.
Wow, I remember.
The story he tells about Tony, like he goes to Tony Garea to get a draw, and he's like, he thinks Garea's joking. He's like, I already gave you a fucking draw. And he's like, he just keeps forgetting it. He just not sure what's going on. And he's like, oh, wait, we're in Pittsburgh. And then he finds Corey Graves because Corey Graves is there as an extra.
That's really funny. That's really funny. I forgot about that.
And this is also when they I guess they even looked more alike because like it was Punk. When they both had the long hair and the like stubbly beard and all that.
Yeah.
So
well, anyway, I think now that we're talking about contemporary wrestling, we absolutely need
that's
to
our
end
sign.
This show.
Although the one thing I did want to say though was that I think just the thing to keep in mind, like I said, with Diesel though, I mean that's Vince 21 years ago and he didn't get what made Diesel over.
Look, 1995, 1996 WWF was the road they would have continued going on if Nitro never started.
Yep.
They weren't gonna change up. They were forced to because there was a fear of everything. But that was the Goon, who? Freddie Joe Floyd? That was the road they were going down. And that's the road they are now.
Pretty much. Farouk Asad with his gladiator helmet.
Yeah, it's all stupid. Everyone has a stupid name. You mean to tell me that whatever his name is more marketable than UHA Nation or Kenta? Like, those names were fine. They changed these names because they feel like these guys are going to develop a name and then they'll leave and go to WCW, which doesn't exist.
I actually like the name Apollo Crews.
UHA Nation's a cool-ass name.
No, UHA Nation is a good name, though.
It's a much more marketable and much cooler than Apollo Crews.
Yeah. All right, so I guess that's it for this week. Still feels weird that we had more of a formatted show, which I assure everyone will never happen again.
Yeah, we'll babble on about so many things next week.
Yeah.
If there's anything specific you want us to talk about with old school wrestling, tweet at David Bix.
And at Great Brian Last.
Well, you could just bother Bix if you want. But yeah, you could do that. But let us know if there's something you want us to talk about. And
I'm almost worried it's not going to be considered as good a show because we didn't ramble as much.
I'm sorry. I promise to ramble more next week.
Good.
I'll drink some wine before the show.
Kosher wine? Drink some kosher wine. That'll get you going good and quick.
I have enjoyed Manischewitz more in the last 2 years than I ever did in my entire life.
Really?
I like drinking it watching Game of Thrones. For some reason, they're all drinking wine on that show, and I feel like Manischewitz is the perfect wine because it's just, you know, in that fantasy medieval kingdom.
It looks like prop wine.
Well, no, but I feel like it's kind of more in tune with what they would be drinking in this fantasy medieval kingdom is like this Concord grape kosher wine. It seems like a good fit. So when Game of Thrones comes back, I'm going to be drinking so much Manischewitz, and I suggest everyone do the same.
Drink it during Raw too. It makes it easier.
I haven't watched Raw in a while, and I'm not going to. Every week I tune in and I see something that makes me turn the TV off so fast. I saw the Dudleys and Tommy Dreamer and I said no, and I turned the TV off right away and I went to my DVR for Bar Rescue.
All right. That's a good note to end on. Follow me on Twitter at David Bix. Follow Brian on Twitter at Great Brian List. Check out Between the Sheets every Monday on Please Be Nation. Check out all my other stuff that'll mention on Twitter, I guess. And I guess that's it. So until next week,
tally-ho. Tally-ho.
Okay, I deserve punishment. How are you going to punish me, Bixie? By keeping me here against my will? Think, Bixie.